prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we discuss underseen horror movies, specifically those which have fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Erica.
I'm Lance.
And this episode, we have a special guest who I mentioned last episode is someone I've been really wanting to have on our show for a long time. And I am thrilled to welcome Bill Ackerman to our show.
Welcome. Hey, thank you so much for inviting me.
Of course.
Welcome.
So I think most folks know you, Bill, as a host of the excellent and one of my favorite podcasts, Supporting Characters, where you interview the folks who are more sort of not even behind the scenes of making films, but writing about film, contributions to special features, things like that. And a lot of our guests we've had, you've interviewed on your show. So I basically use your podcast as a like, who should I get as a guest for our podcast?
Yeah. I was just going to say, they're all great people to have. Well, most of them are great people to have for a show like this. So I'm glad you're doing that if you are doing that.
Yeah. It's a great primer for that. But I don't want to just pigeonhole you into one thing because you also co-host the Directors Club podcast. Can you tell folks a little bit more about that?
Well, Directors Club was the first podcast I was ever on as a guest years ago. And the founder of the show, Jim Laskowski, wanted to have a little bit more downtime in his own schedule. So I agreed to take on some part-time hosting duties. I haven't actually done one in a little while. I've actually been wrestling with a 15-hour Jean-Luc Godard episode for show. So that's that's been taking up a lot of my time when I have time to even do podcasting. But I've done episodes for his show on Stephen Sadian with Justine Smith and Heather Drain. I did one on Mia Hansen-Love. I did one on Ken Russell with Sam Deegan, who's been on your show. Mm-hmm. And the Godard episode will have a few people who know your show might know, like Elric Kane is on it, and Stephanie Crawford, Sam Deegan is on that one, Will Sloan from Important Cinema Club, Molly Haskell, Danny Perry, a bunch of people are going to be on it. But it's just a giant thing to edit down. I think it's going to be like 6 to 8 episodes long, maybe.
Oh, wow.
But I'm trying to cover the whole gamut, like, of his body of work, and it's 50 years of very challenging cinema to kind of get my head around. And so I've just been doing a little bit of like home video supplements, and my day job has been very busy, and my family situation has been a little bit complicated this year. So it's been a lot, on my plate. So podcasting has been a little bit kind of compromised this year in terms of my schedule, but I was happy to make time for this, and I will be, like I said, finishing that 15-hour Godard behemoth at some point this month. So but Directors Club is something that is over at the Now Playing Network, which also has my Supporting Characters episodes, mm-hmm. and my much more niche little Blue Velvet podcast that I did a few years ago that has crew interviews from Blue Velvet from the neighborhood. But that's some of my podcast stuff, I guess.
Yeah. You spoiled my transition here because I was actually going to say, we're not actually talking about the movie in the title, folks. We're going to just be talking about David Lynch this episode. So let Lance and Bill can geek out.
Oh, yeah. I just went to the house where Bill Pullman lives in Lost Highway while I was in Los Angeles.
Oh, sick.
Yeah, it's creepy in real life. But Erica, you'll also be happy that I also went to the flower shop where the son works in Mortuary. Oh. So I did mix it up with the highbrow and lowbrow.
I love it.
Locations.
Excellent. So I had mentioned a few of your physical media contributions at the end of our last episode, such as mm-hmm. Radiance's Messiah of Evil, Second Sight's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Fun City Edition's Natural Enemies. Is there anything else that's been recently announced or even just contributions that you're particularly fond of that you'd like our listeners to know about?
For recently announced, I think the only thing that's been announced that I can talk about is the Messiah of Evil. I did do a video essay for Sheila Levine is Dead and Living in New York, but I don't know that that's a big horror title. I guess the things I'm proudest of, I mean, The Last House on the Left with Amanda Reyes mm-hmm. for Arrow is probably still going to be my sentimental favorite. She and I also did Fade to Black, which I think a few people would probably dig, which is a Vinegar Syndrome slasher movie title.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the Al Adamson collection box said, if you don't already have it, you know, maybe go to the bank and take out a small loan, you know, to pick up a copy. But the book we did for that is also something I was really proud of. But I'm trying to think, horror stuff. I mean, those are probably the big ones. I mean, the chainsaw is obviously like always going to probably be the biggest thing I've ever sure. involved with. But Messiah of Evil is one of my favorite films. Oh, and Death Dream. I did the commentary for Death Dream with Travis Crawford, the late, great Travis Crawford, mm-hmm. for 101 Films. That's, you know, immediately was rendered obsolete by Blue Underground announcing a 4K edition like a week later. But yeah. If you want to hear Travis and I talk about Vietnam horror and Bob Clark and all that, I mean, it's a great, I guess it's a Region B release for Bob Clark's Death Dream. That's some of the stuff I worked on.
I think we've converted a few of our listeners to get region free players. So yeah, Lance being the first one.
Oh yeah. Necessary.
Game changer. Yeah.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm also proud of the solo commentary I did for The People Next Door, the psychedelics and suburbia film from 1970. You know, David Green, that's for Scorpion releasing. That and Natural Enemies are the only solo commentaries I've done, but yeah, you know, they're a ton of work, as you can imagine. So I try to let people know that they exist.
Yeah. And, you know, folks out there, appreciate the work that goes into one person doing a commentary by themselves. Like, it's a lot.
It's a lot of work.
I mean, we talk about one movie here for about an hour between two people, sometimes three. And we're not even talking about the movie itself for the majority or for most of the time. So there's a lot of work that goes into it. So if you buy any of these Blu-rays, especially the boutique labels that have these special features that get someone to do a commentary for it, take the time to listen to it because a lot of work really did go into that.
Yeah. I mean, I pick up these releases solely for the commentary and the special features. Because a lot of these movies, you know, I own, but when you have, you know, commentary like Bill and, you know, Sam and everybody out there doing this work, that makes it worth the purchase.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got to say that someone that's been on both of our shows that I was so excited to see join the commentary ranks was Abraham Castillo Flores.
Yes.
Anytime you've heard anyone on my show do commentaries, I probably have bought that release, even if I have like three copies of that film. I really am interested in hearing everybody try this field out and, like, you know, excel at it. So, and I know that you might have something news to share in the future along those lines yourself. And so I will, you know, obviously be buying it for the commentary alone.
Yes, I might very much. Yeah. Thanks to you, Bill, actually. Can't tell folks what it is yet, but I think I have a couple of listeners who know the film and are going to be really excited about it. So that's all I can say for now.
Yes.
Okay, so before we get into the film, I do want to let folks know that we will be announcing our Horror Gives Back categories at the end of the episode, so be sure to stick around for that. For those of you who are new here, hello. And so Horror Gives Back is our annual charity challenge where we ask participants to donate $1 or more per horror movie that they watch in October. So we have prompts or categories that you can follow, or you can go out on your own and just, you know, watch whatever horror movies you're feeling. That's fine. You can listen to our previous Horror Gives Back episodes to get a sense of what to expect. Last year, we had our best year ever. It just gets better every year.
It does.
But we raised over $1,400 for Best Friends Animal Society. And so we definitely hope more folks will join in so that we can surpass that figure this year. Okay, before we get to that, though, and I know folks are excited about Horror Gives Back, but I'm excited to talk about this movie from 1980, and that is Night of Death.
You got to yell it.
Night of Death. So as of this recording, Night of Death has 817 views on Letterboxd. It has a Synapse DVD release as well as some recent foreign Blu-ray releases, one from Camera Obscura and the other from... Disclaimer, I am going to fuck up everything that I have to pronounce in French in this episode. Sorry, folks. We continue our tradition after Shawgust with that. Les Chats qui Fument is the other label that released a Blu-ray. It is also available to watch online at fdupmovies.com. There's a link in show notes to that. If you can, though, you know, try to support the physical media release. The Synapse DVD doesn't have anything supplementary-wise, but if you buy it, that will pretty much guarantee that it'll get a domestic Blu-ray release. Someone out there. So
yeah.
I bought two copies. That should have guaranteed that it got a release.
You did your work, yeah.
I know. It did have another re-release in 1988 by Columbus Video as The Claws of Death or Les Griffes de la Mort. I think I pronounced that correctly.
It's good.
Yeah. Thank you.
I approve.
Coming from the person after Shoggoth who mispronounces everything.
Oh, jeez.
Worst. All right. So Night of Death is about a young woman named Martine. She takes a job that her boyfriend Serge found for her as a nurse at a place called Deadlock House. It's this creepy retirement home in the French countryside. Seems to have a pretty high turnover when it comes to their nurses that they employ there. However, when she shows up a day early. So the other nurse, there's still another nurse there. And so the owner of the residence basically tells her like, oh yeah, I hired her because you were complaining all the time about having too much work. So the other nurse, Nicole, she shows Martine the ropes a bit. And the administrator, Helene, is busying herself continuously playing one song on the piano, which is pretty much the score of the film. And we'll talk about that as well. On Martine's first night, she actually does go out with her boyfriend, even though there is a rule that the new nurse can't leave the house for 2 months. And the owner says that's basically so that the residents can get to know them. But we know there's another reason. We'll get to that later. So Martine goes out. Nicole is taken from her bed and by the crazed residents, all dressed up for the night. And we find out very early on that the elderly residents of Deadlock House are cannibals, and soon they make Nicole their next meal. Martine's next on the menu, but she may have a chance to escape due to the residents' infighting. While all this is going on inside Deadlock House, there is also a serial killer on the loose nearby called the Golden Needle Serial Killer. I think I got pretty much. I don't want to get too far into
it. Yeah, we'll get to the end.
Yeah, we'll get to the end because that's the doozy here. All right, so getting to the crew here. This is directed and co-written by Raphael Delpard. He actually did more acting than writing and directing. He has 10 directing credits and 13 writing credits, but 21 acting credits. In the late 90s, he focused primarily on documentaries, which I think kind of makes sense because this is where he started focusing more on writing books, many of them about historical events such as the Indochina War and the Algerian War. He has over 30 published novels and nonfiction books.
Wow.
So he's much more prolific on that end than he is in the film industry. So the only other film that I watched that he has directed is the only other one that I think is in the horror realm. And Bill, I saw you had rewatched this one recently, and that's Clash from 1984. When did you first watch that film? Do you recall?
Let's see. I think it was Thursday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, I'd never seen it before. I'd never actually seen this before prepping for this episode.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. No. And Clash. Yeah, I did watch the Blu-ray transfer that. So I think there's a really pixelated version on YouTube that people can find, but
it's horrific.
It's hard to really make out what's going on. I think there might even be some sync issues with that transfer. But
there are, yes.
Yeah, it's an unusual film. I mean, it's not an easy recommend, but it's got some memorable imagery. It's kind of like one of those films that starts off like a crime film that then kind of transforms into like a one set location with like an eerie presence, you know, and this woman. I don't want to give the whole plot away because I'm assuming most people haven't seen it, but it's I'm still kind of puzzling over because I felt like it almost felt like too long for its premise, but it had a lot of striking images, so I wouldn't discourage people, but I also don't think it's like as good a film as Night of Death, and probably not necessarily the hidden gem you want it to be, but not uninteresting.
I'd agree with all of that 100%. I do think it was too long for what it is. I think for folks, the premise of it, we have a woman named Martine, just like in Night of Death. Her boyfriend has asked her to hide out in this abandoned factory for the night with a briefcase full of money that he's stolen. And there are like a lot of really cool elements in there and what happens to her during the night. There's creepy mannequins. and there's a strange man stalker, and there's an adorable cat. Just always mention the cat. Again, don't watch the copy on YouTube. It's the audio is not synced up right. You can barely see anything. And you really, if you are going to watch it, you do want to be able to see it. Yeah. So the cinematographer on this is Sacha Vierney, who's worked with Peter Greenaway on films such as The Cook, The Thief, His Wife and His Lover, The Baby of Macan, The Pillow Book, and Drowning by Numbers. He also shot Luis Buñuel's Belle du Jour. So you definitely want to see this film. Yeah. So do not watch the YouTube version. If you have access to Legal Adjacent, you know, try to find that. Maybe it'll get a domestic release. It does have, I think I even saw on Diabolik DVD site that they had, you know, the foreign Blu-ray that got released for it, but that's out of print. So
yeah, yeah. And for any Possession fans listening, the Andrzej Żuławski's La Femme Publique is also another Sacha Vierney credit that's worth checking out. That's kind of like horror adjacent, I guess.
Nice. So yeah, that was the only other film that I've seen by Delpard. And, you know, looking at his filmography, it is fairly limited, and it's not easy to find a lot of his films because he's not one of the more notable French directors out there. So
yeah, I tried to watch Clash. I started two on YouTube, but I shut it down pretty quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to wait.
I pushed through, and I was like,
well done.
Yeah, I eventually did watch that version, and then I was like, okay, you know what? I'm just going to suck it up. Legal Adjacent, it is. And found that, and I was like, okay, this is much better. But still, yeah. I do think it would have made a much better short film, I think, for what it was.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm not the genre lan expert that a lot of my friends are, but I feel like France is not a country that is that welcoming or encouraging to horror directors around this time. I think maybe that changes when like the new French extremity type people come in. But I think Roland, we probably would know best for French director auteurs, and he's just kind of stubbornly going at it regardless of whether or not anyone likes the films. Yeah. But I think that like for someone like Raphael Delpard, maybe there was just more of an audience for other work outside the genre. Because I think this is a fairly obscure title. I mean, even within France, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think so too. And I mean, that I have this point for later on during the film discussion, but I think it makes sense now to talk about, is I did see a couple of reviews that actually called this one of the earliest examples of the French extreme. And in my mind, I'm only really familiar with new French extremity, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, and so forth. And I mean, I guess I could say there's an argument for that with the gore, albeit it's pretty limited to just a couple of scenes. But, you know, true French extremity to me is much more excessive and deliberate in its boundary pushing. And I guess I don't know. Like, I agree that there wasn't really much going on at this time. You know, Roland is sort of past his prime at 1980 and kind of winding down a little bit. And then we have a few one-offs that come mid-80s, like Au Grof, masterpiece, Killing Spree, Devil Story, another masterpiece. So I don't know. I don't know that I would say that this is part of the French extreme. I think it's just this weird little outlier.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. I don't think this is part of any kind of school or movement. And I also don't even think of Roland as part of any kind of movement. They feel like little islands, you know, in a country that is not really developing a horror culture or horror film kind of scene at all.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So getting back to crew, the cinematography is by Marcel Combes. He shot Don't Deliver Us from Evil from 1971. This has a Mondo Macabre release and a high recommendation from me, because if you like Alucarda or Poison for the Fairies, this is right up your alley.
Or Heavenly Creatures.
Heavenly Creatures too, as well. Yeah, absolutely. I always forget that one when I'm thinking about like the creepy girl.
Well, they're based on the same story, right?
I just, for whatever reason, I don't know why I always forget that one. I think
stylistically, like, they're nothing apart. I mean, I would think of Alucarda first also. But
I think Peter Jackson has just like gotten on my nerves recently. So maybe that's why I don't know what it is. He also shot Melville's The Second Wind, starring Lino Ventura. This was actually a first-time watch for me. I watched it this week. It's the Criterion's been sitting on my shelf for, well, since John moved in. And I got to say, I did really like it, but I prefer Le Cercle Rouge. I just do. Bill, preferences on Melville? Ice movies?
I mean, I guess Le Cercle Rouge is probably my favorite of what I've seen. There's a lot that I haven't seen. I mean, I like all the big ones like everyone else. I mean, Army of Shadows is good.
Yeah.
Le Samurai is good.
Le Samurai as well. I think maybe I just have a Alain Delon preference more than anything. I love, not to discount Lino Ventura, I love that man. But
yeah,
you tell me Alain Delon's in it, I'm going to watch it.
Yeah.
I might give it a little bit higher rating just because of that. And this may actually impact my double feature pick later, just saying. Score is by Laurent Petit-Girard. Lance, any thoughts about the score?
I mean, I love the score. As soon as the movie starts, it kind of sets the tone that you're in for hopefully a creepy experience. So I was completely captivated by this story, and I wanted to watch something else that Laurent Petit-Girard did, and I watched Otto Preminger's Rosebud from 1975. Mm-hmm. I don't know if, Bill, you've seen that, starring Peter O'Toole.
I own it, but I have not seen it yet.
Yeah, it's an odd, very odd film, kind of a snooze fest. I mean, it's weirdly edited, but it stars Richard Attenborough's in it, Cliff Gorman. There's a very young Kim Cattrall and Isabella Huppert, which is... The cast is amazing, but Petit-Girard's score, I feel like he was the wrong man for the job because it's a little too wild for what's kind of happening.
Oh, okay.
And it's, I mean, I love the original score in Night of Death, though. I think it's the recurring moaning throughout. There's a piano melody. There's like some chaotic violin melodies happening out. Yeah, something terrible is bound to occur when you're watching this, and the setup is perfect. And he's still, I saw that he was still doing work. Yeah. He's on Spotify. Like he had a release as recent as 2023, which kind of blew me away.
All right. So getting into the cast. So at the time of filming, all of the cast were pretty much unknowns. So the first is Isabelle Goguet. I think that's how you pronounce it. She plays Martine. She only has 6 film credits. I could not find any of the other movies that she is in outside of Legal Adjacent. She does have 11 credits as an assistant director, though, in the late 70s and early 80s, which is interesting. The actress with the most credits, Charlotte de Turckheim, she plays Nicole, the other nurse. She's pretty much the only one to go on to have a successful acting career with over 70 credits between film and television. She's still acting to this day. She's even done some writing and directing. And if you look at Letterboxd, it looks like Night of Death is her first film credit. But if you go to IMDb, you will actually find that her first film credit is a sex film directed by Bernard Lanoy, who gifted this world with Devil Story in 1986.
Yes.
Yeah. She just played a cyclist, though. No hardcore scenes, from what I understand. I did not watch this film. I'm not saying I won't in the future, but I did not watch this one. Because, you know, a sex film by the guy who directed Devil Story, I'm already like, my brain's already like, yes, please.
Yeah. Well, hopefully there's not a lot of wild horses running around.
Hopefully there are. Dance. All right. Then we have Betty Beckers. She plays Helene, the administrator. She was also in La Vérité and The Dogs, which was recently released by Severin. That's from 1979. Then we have, I think, who's probably my, if I had to play a favorite, this might be my favorite character. And that's Flavian, the groundskeeper. He's played by Michel Flavius. This is his only acting credit. And the first time I watched it, I was like, who does he look like?
Yeah.
This is driving me nuts. And then the second time I watched it, it clicked.
It Lance, popped. I mean, I think it's, I don't know if it's the same guy, but Peter Stormare,
yes,
from the Coen brothers. Yeah. Fargo. Yeah. I mean, his face is like so recognizable. When he said he just has one credit, it's kind of surprising because he looks so much like, I don't know, a character actor that pop up in hundreds of movies.
Yeah.
He has that face.
I think maybe he only has one acting credit because he looks so much like Peter Stormare. And Stormare probably went to him and was like, hey, doppelganger, this is my territory. I don't know.
I totally see it.
Yeah. It's uncanny how much he looks like him. It's like they could be twin brothers. They literally look like they could be twin brothers. Like
he should have played the part in Nacho Libre to send Nacho to the cliff.
I am.
And no, Nacho, no, I got nothing. Okay.
I'm sorry. No, I'm not seeing Nacho Libre. I cannot.
Peter Stormare is really funny in that movie.
Okay. Well, one of our listeners is laughing at your joke, Lance. Maybe two. Then a couple of just sort of side characters. We have Mr. Leon. He is the man who's in the wheelchair sometimes, mainly just to bother people. Also a magician. And he's got a fake spider on a wand.
Yeah. You're picking favorites with Flavian. I'd have to say Mr. Leon's probably one of my favorites. He can wheel around in a wheelchair just to mess with people.
Yeah.
Fake spiders. I kind of want to be him.
Yeah. I think my close second would probably be Mr. Jules, who's the communist knitter.
Mr. Jules was my favorite as well.
Nice. Yeah. I guess that kind of brings me to a point, like with the characters is, and I don't know how you would feel about this either, Lance or Bill, both of you being huge David Lynch fans. I wanted this to be more, have more time. There's only seven elderly residents here, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. And we have the two nurses, and then we have the groundskeeper, the administrator, Helene. And I guess, you know, there's the grocery delivery person who we'll talk about later, and then the boyfriend. But I kind of wanted this to be more Twin Peaks, where we got a little bit more with each character and like their kind of quirkiness. And I think you get that a little bit with Mr. Jules, the communist knitter, and Mr. Leon, but
yeah.
The others get kind of sidelined.
I kind of got it from Madame Helene too. Like to me, she's very kind of Catherine Martel vibes, like Piper Laurie. She's very diabolical. She's very domineering. It's clear she has a secret, and she seems totally in control of this, you know, this secret. So I did get some Twin Peaks vibes, but I always search for it when I watch movies. her eating in front of the mirror while the hired help that, you know, just stands behind her while she's waiting to sign. That felt very Twin Peaks-ish to me as well. Like, but I get what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, I do think the cast of characters and the crazy patients kind of what really sells it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I did wish it went a little harder, but it kind of delivers on that awkward, out of place, dark humor, which I love from, you know, these type of serious situations like it does in Twin Peaks.
Yeah,
I wasn't sure if Mr. Leon's mustache was supposed to evoke Salvador Dali, but I did think of other surrealist films. But you know, I didn't think of Lynch, but you're right. I mean, I do see the Catherine Martel also with Helene as far as the framing of the, you know, her in the mirror and her demeanor is kind of like Piper Laurie in that show. But yeah, and I mean, I thought of a bunch of other things, but I hadn't really thought of Lynch with this. But I can see it. I guess I can see. How you'd want more of a development of the other elderly people in the home. Cause yeah, they don't really get a lot of time with them. And I don't know if, you know, this is something that just the space of a 90 minute film, they didn't have time to develop those characters. But I was wondering if Mr. Jules was supposed to be like a parody of the French left, you know, with his kind of whole persona, like the way he's always talking about revolution, like literally wearing red.
Yeah.
Like I was reminded, because I've been working on a 15 hour Godard podcast. So I'm like, is this supposed to be saying something about Jean-Luc? I don't know. I thought it was. And then they have Flavian constantly carrying around a right-wing newspaper. So I'm like, is there like a political thing going on with this that I haven't quite picked up on yet? I don't know if that's something that either of you were going to bring up, but this is something I'm thinking of with the residents. Like, are they supposed to be symbolizing something? Is this like just a genre film, or is this supposed to be like an allegory for something that I'm totally missing?
I think it's trying to, but I don't think it's getting there. And I think that's kind of a commonality with a lot of elements in this film, like, you know, full character development and that sort of thing. I was asking myself, is this saying something about class conflict, or like the rich or upper class eating the poor, lower working class? Yes, but not strongly. Is it saying something politically about the far right? Yes, but not strongly. Like, you know, it just sort of like drops these things in, but it doesn't go full force, I think.
Right. Well, isn't there a line? I can't remember which woman says it at the end. Like, you know, we may be monsters, but we're not as bad as the people outside in the real world, or something to that effect. You know the line I'm talking about?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have that.
Yeah, right, so here. I think that's totally picking up. Yeah, the class consciousness thing is definitely there. I mean, but yeah, it's so soft-pedaled. And, you know, the delivery boy at the end is, I don't know what class he's supposed to be, but yeah, there's, I don't want to spoil the ending, but yeah, it is a case where, yeah, no, there's not like romanticizing one side or the other. I mean, the first nursemaid is supposed to be like a little bit kind of bitchy, I guess. Mm-hmm. Although I find her sympathetic, but I mean, you know, it's definitely saying something about, you know, the rich eating the poor for sure.
Yeah. I think that was the only thing that came in a little obvious and heavy-handed, but, you know, like what it's trying to say with that and some other elements, you know, it's there's a, you know, that's kind of one of the things that frustrates me a little bit about it. And I think the other thing is that the mystery of what's happening at Deadlock House is not for us, but it's for Martine. And these types of films can sometimes be frustrating for folks to watch. Sometimes it is for me, but sometimes everything else, like all the elements, like the atmosphere and the score and the setting here, really make up for it for me. But, you know, when we already know what the quote unquote mystery is here, and we're waiting for Martine to figure it out, and we're just like, she's playing catch up. That can be frustrating.
You weren't on the edge of your seat not knowing the identity of the Golden Needle
killer.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. So there is no real mystery. So I feel like in the background, they're like, okay, those who might be bored with the cannibalistic old people know what's going on. Let's introduce the serial killer an hour into the movie.
You know? I mean, if you apply Giallo, you know, logic, you're like, okay, who's the only other character left? It's the delivery boy. Sorry, I spoiled it, but
I'm gonna go with another look. Like, I mean, I saw James Woods as soon as he popped up too. I was like, okay, he's the golden needle killer. He's gotta be. He's too sweet and he looks like James Woods.
Bill, when it comes to movies where, like, you know, the reveal comes early on and we're watching our main character try to figure it out, I kind of think of something like Columbo, where we already know how they committed the murder. And then the rest of the episode is about us watching Columbo figure it out and basically, like, set up the killer to, like, make them think like he's kind of bumbling, not knowing what he's doing. And then eventually they get caught at the end. So there's, like, it works in that sense, but I don't know. Do you ever have it take issue with movies that reveal early and you're waiting for the main character to play catch up with you?
Sometimes. I mean, with a film like this, I think I know from scene one that there's a conspiracy and that, you know, I can pick up pretty early what the twist is going to be because there's so many films that do this kind of plot.
Right.
I think with a lot of horror like this, I think I watch it more for how the story is told than for the surprise element. So, I mean, unless it's a giallo where I always forget who the killer is, and so I'm always surprised every time, unless it's something like Deep Red where I really memorized it. I usually don't remember who the killer is in a giallo movie. But like something like this, I don't think the suspense is necessarily what I'm drawn to. It's kind of just the tone and the music and the characters and how, like, maybe the humor of it more so. Because I've watched this three times, like, over the last couple of weeks, like, before we were sitting down to record this. And I do think it's a good, like, Sunday afternoon horror film. Like, it's not especially scary or especially smart, but it is like a satisfying kind of moody afternoon watch. You know, it's like, you know, an old creepy mansion and, you know, mysterious goings on in the shadows. And it's well made for what it's doing, I think, but it's just, I wouldn't say it's especially scary, and I feel like I can name films that do what it does better. But, you know, I do think it's got real character to it as far as, like, the performances, and, like, everyone seems, like, well cast. I think that's, like, 90% of what makes it so good, and it also has a great setting. And those things count for a lot when it comes to this. I was trying to find the mansion this morning. Like, is it?
Did you find it? Because I hit a wall. I couldn't find it.
No, I couldn't find it. Is it Senlis, the village that it shot in? I couldn't.
That's the only thing I could find, but I couldn't find the actual.
Yeah, I started just doing. I mean, I only just kind of spent like a few minutes on it. I might be able to find it, but like image searches of the exterior shot of the front of the castle only bring up stills from the film, and then every mansion I looked at just didn't have the right architecture to it. So, like, I don't know. Like, there's not like a Night of Death tour for fans in that village, unfortunately.
What? But
I know it's like,
go start one.
I'll write to the government there. And
there you go.
At least a plaque.
Yeah, the scenery, that Deadlock House is just, you know, a main character in and of itself. It gets like all those transition scenes where it's just this impending doom sounding like pipe organ chord, or it might even be like a gong or large chime. It's just gong and it shows it. I love that. I mean, it's like you said, Bill, it's just like this kind of feeling, and the exterior shots of that house, and then also that boiler room house mm-hmm. that Flavian's in a lot. But the Deadlock house kind of, it, every time it showed the Deadlock house with that weird, deadly note, the Overlook Hotel, like I kept getting, and I do this quite a bit, but, you know, comparing movies, a lot of people don't like to do, but it did put me in a mood, you know, released the same year. I think Shining was released a little earlier, 1980, but it reminded me of this, of The Shining, for even from the opening credits, you know, just the dark music and then the simple kind of texts that were popping up online. Yeah.
Well, you know, he was originally going to have an exclamation point in The Shining, with it, right. But they talked him out of it at the last minute. Otherwise, the comparison would be even stronger.
Well, yeah, Night of Death even has that "Here's Johnny" moment when Martine pulls out the axe. I was like waiting for.
Oh
like,
yeah,
yeah.
Here we go. Here it is.
Oh yeah, I agree. Like I bring up the mystery not for the viewer aspect because like so I you know when I did my second rewatch last night. With John, who had never seen it before, he didn't really care for it, but he gets really frustrated with movies that he already knows. So he's much right. more dependent on that mystery aspect.
But the ending didn't surprise him.
No, he had that figured out as well. But like, you know, the thing that kills me about him though is I'm not trying to go into my relationship therapy session here or anything, but what frustrates me about watching movies with him is that he gets annoyed with movies like this that have that reveal early on and we're waiting for the person to catch up and figure it out. Mm-hmm. Like if a movie has that, it's automatically,
it's too late.
It kills it for him. Like he can't look at the other stuff like that we're talking about, like the score and the setting and the characters and all these other things. Right. So, and it's like, the Golden Needle character or the Golden Needle serial killer at the end, of course, I'm like, okay, he's the only character left. It's obviously him, but how the movie ends, like all of a sudden with him, I fucking love it. It's like a giallo ending. I'm like, out of nowhere, and he just pops up and just sticks a fucking needle in her throat.
And I'm like, and yes. He is just yelling in ecstasy. I love it. Yeah, no, I can get that. I mean, kind of the mystery. It's obviously we've already talked about it. It's immediately revealed. I was hoping I would get a little more explanation on the purpose of this 2-month timeline, what their goal is, what their mission is, like to prolong their life. I didn't know if there was any type of end goal, because didn't they say there is some sort of like, they were mentioning, I think that there is some sort of like, almost like a mission, or they have some sort of end goal.
Yeah.
But it's never really hinted on, is it?
Yeah, no, it's not. And I think that's one of those things, like it doesn't get explained, and we can go in with some sort of assumption about it where, okay, this 2-month thing is part of their ritual where, because we saw what happened to Helene after everyone started getting killed and they weren't able to kill Martine and eat her. She immediately became old.
Right.
So apparently this 2-month thing is like a very strict timeline as part of the ritual. And they never say that outright. Like, is this part of like a pact with the devil, or is it this, or is it that? And I do kind of like it when stuff is left up to us to decide and figure that out. Like I rewatched Brotherhood of Satan last night, and that does that, I think, really well, where it just throws you right in and just, you have to figure out or just not figure out and just accept that you're not going to be told how this started, why this happens, you know, all these other things. And I do kind of, sometimes it can frustrate me, but if it's done well, getting back to something that, you know, Bill had said earlier about certain elements being done, if they're done well, it works for me.
Yeah, it does. I appreciate, like, you know, letting the viewer figure out and come up with their own kind of backstories and plots and stuff.
That's I mean, since we mentioned Lynch earlier, that's something I think I learned early on from growing up watching his films, is that, you know, sometimes the ambiguity is more satisfying than it all kind of neatly lining up and all having a logical flow to it. And sometimes, like, you have getting a chance to kind of fill in the blanks can be a pleasure, not a frustration. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't quite understand what exactly the issue is with Flavian, and you had no right to make me so ugly. Like, I can fill in the blanks as to what's happening with his character and like what he's commenting on as far as his appearance, but I'm filling it in the blanks from other stories. I don't remember mm-hmm. if the film ever really explains what he's talking about there. I mean,
yeah, it definitely does not.
And I think that's okay. But I mean, I think, you know, the rules behind it, I mean, there's other kinds of films that would spell out. So 2 months on the 28th, they've got to eat a girl or something's got to happen. I mean,
yeah.
I was looking for like, is the one child, one old person kind of, you know, mantra of, you know, Mr. Jules. Like, I wasn't sure if that was supposed to have some kind of hidden code, but I mean, beyond like just him kind of ranting it, like as he's blinded, you know, and so he's tying it to the horror, but it's not really spelled out. And that's, you know, I can fill in the blanks enough on my own that doesn't trouble me. I think I'd rather probably have more questions and like, okay, they've over-explained everything. It's getting a little bit, you know, silly.
Yeah, it makes watching the movie just that much more enjoyable because you're looking for clues. And I think you're more focused on all these weird things that are happening. Because one of my favorite scenes is when Flavian is, you know, setting up that dummy, puts Nicole's dress on.
That's my favorite.
The red lampshade lighting on the wood panel walls, like there's the framing. This is one of, you know, all the exterior shots are just gorgeous in this movie, mm-hmm. but I feel like the angle shots and the framing and the lighting interior too. And it's essentially a single location movie, like a lot of French horror. But yeah, that scene is when he's flipping out, you know, and just crawling on the ground and Martine's behind the curtain. I mean, that's my favorite scene of the movie. I felt like I was looking for clues. Like he's dropping hints of what I want to know about the story, but they're not there. And it becomes so, the ambiguity is just so intriguing.
Bill, do you have a favorite scene or scenes from the film?
I'm trying to think. It might be just the shots of the workshed, you know, where Flavian works, like just those establishing shots. Like I just like how the location kind of is established. I mean, in terms of action, I do like, you know, the ankle biting at the end, I guess, and the hand chopping. But it's not like a film that really has like one set piece that springs to mind is like, oh, it's clearly that. I mean, I think I really like the song at the end. I thought that was like a really surprisingly good little theme song for this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
That was great. I like the, besides the mannequin or dummy doll scene with Flavian, the old men, like, I like how they establish that they're young at heart as them basically just being perverts. Like, you know, one of them wants to cuddle with her and the other one's like got his cane and is trying to look up her skirt while she's cleaning the windows and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, that's cute.
Yeah. When she was just like succumbing to that cuddle scene.
Yeah.
I wanted to know what her resume was because she is such a good caretaker. Like, what was her job? Like, she had an 8-month break, I guess, in jobs. And I salute Martine. She is an absolute like joy, like to have in an old person's home like that.
Yeah,
it's funny. You mentioned The Shining, and one thing I was going to say: when the whole group of the elderly vampires, you know, walk the halls at night,
yeah.
they walk towards the camera, posed in formation like they're posing for a portrait.
Mm.
Like if you compare it to like the ghouls in like Messiah of Evil that kind of just walk normally, or even the Shambolic movement of zombie movie kind of zombies,
yeah.
They just all walk in formation like they're like at any moment they could freeze and be like perfectly arranged for a portrait. And I thought that was like an odd kind of choice because it makes the whole thing more stylized in feel. Like, I mean, even the way that like people stand behind Helene when she's, you know, ready to count her calories after the meal, you know, there's always like this deliberate framing, but not like, not like art film, like it never turns into like Robert Bresson or something like that. Like it's always kind of like still like naturalistic enough, but it is stagey in ways that I think make it like heightened and odd, and you know, as opposed to just like arty and distracting.
Yeah,
yeah, and they're all dressed too for the ritual, like with their bow ties and stuff for that during that march. It's very stylized.
Yeah,
that also makes me think of Messiah of Evil, and also Let's Scare Jessica to Death when they gather around the bed.
Yeah,
you know, but that whole notion of like one generation feeding on the young people, which in American films feels more like a reflection of generation clash, but maybe in this it's more like class clash.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean that notion of like, yeah, the rich feeding on the poor, and that in, you know, or the old feeding on the young. But those are two films that matter a lot to me. And so when I see things that kind of evoke that, I'm like, oh, that's, you know, interesting. But I wonder if those films even had any kind of impact in France on someone like Raphael Del Pardo, or just like they pull from the same influences.
Yeah, there's not too much information out there about this film. And one of the reviews that I read, they had a write-up about this film, and this was one of the people who actually was trying to make a case for this being part of the French Extremity, which I understand like their argument for it, but I don't agree with it. But he had mentioned in there, and this ended up on Delpard's Wikipedia page, which, you know, we all know is full of facts, but it had said that Toby Hooper was a fan of this film and that he had sent Delpard a telegram regarding this film, like congratulating him on it. But I literally could find that information nowhere else except for on the Wikipedia page, which was citing the article that was a review that I read. So I have no idea where that information came from. So I can't say if it's true or not.
Right.
But I do think that, you know, if it did have a release here, so some people in the horror circles probably did see it. And I would think that Delpard probably saw some of the other films like Bill's talking about that would have had some kind of influence. Cause it's like, if we're seeing it as fans, you would, I don't know if we're placing our bias on it because we're such fans of those films and we see those things in other films that we watch, or if those are intentional. And it's hard to know with a director like Delpard, who there's not that much information about him or even him talking about this film.
Yeah, I always assume that a lot of people that make horror films are not necessarily horror fans. Like I just from my experience looking into the making of a lot of them, a lot of these films tend to be from people that see this as a commercial way in to have a successful film, have it be seen, get your chops up directing film, and then move into other genres. And I mean, the fact that he didn't stay making horror films the way someone like Roland was committed to making them. Mm-hmm. Suggest that maybe, I mean, for all I know, this is like the most sincere film he ever made. I mean, I'm not trying to say that it wasn't, but I mean, my guess a lot of times, I mean, certainly Let's Scare Jessica to Death and Messiah of Evil, since I mentioned those, I mean, those directors went on to do mostly work outside the genre. And right. I mean, Toby Hooper was somebody that was a horror fan. I remember, for some reason, I always think about this because John Waters in his book Shock Value always mentions, like, first time meeting Toby Hooper, like they, I guess, sat at a bar talking about horror movies. I'm like, why couldn't that have been recorded for posterity?
Oh,
like, what would they talk about? You know, but was it just Herschel Gordon Lewis, or, you know, were they talking about Night of Death? Like, I sent him a telegram,
right.
John.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I have no idea. But yeah, but I do think about, like, for every Dario Argento that seems to really love the horror genre, like, there's a lot of people that just saw this as a means to get established, you know, to make other things. It's a job. So when it comes to, like, are they pulling from other horror films? I mean, sometimes that was just like, oh, let's, how are other people doing it? Let's take some cues. And then other people might be coming as fans. I don't know. I think something like Messiah of Evil might have had a better reception overseas. I don't know. That's kind of a slow building thing. But someone like Jess Franco, I have no idea, like, what kind of following he would have had in 1980 in France versus, I mean, the kind of following he got, like, in the Video Watchdog Eyeball era onward, you know, where it's like his reputation is something different now. But yeah, and so, same with Roland. I mean, Immortal Tales is still like 10 years, you know, to come or whatever. Like the rehabilitation of a lot of this stuff, I think, was not a thing in 1980. I mean, this was just a scare picture. But I don't know. Do you have a sense of like how it was received at the time, even in France? I didn't look into this. Was it something that had any kind of impact at all, or was it just another programmer kind of thing?
From what I could find, Clash seemed to be much more well received. It ended up at a festival and had some acclaim from critics, but this one did not seem to be very well received. And I think, I mean, it's, you know, it's early on in his career. And I think it is what you're talking about, where it was kind of a way in for him and to get to what he really does like to do, which seems to be more documentary style. He seems to be a huge history buff, which, knowing that, I think that there could be an element of that in this film, where I think there definitely is some sort of political or class conflict underlying message in there because of that, just knowing, like, in the future, like, what his real passion was. But it seemed to be very, like, limited. It did get released over here, not theatrically, but on video. So, I mean, in 88, so.
Yeah, like, Bill, you mentioned a lot of at that time, a lot of horror, you know, French didn't really accept a lot of horror movies, especially probably if there's a lot of gore. Like, is there much gore in Clash? Because I didn't watch it.
There's like one scene in particular, I think.
Okay. Because yeah, and then the story with Hooper is interesting too, because Texas Chainsaw Massacre doesn't have much gore at all. So the gore elements in Night of Death they're surprising. I mean, you have the first murder of Nicole, which is very effective when they cut her open. I mean, that looks
great. Yeah.
And then you have kind of like the spoiler of the cover art on the DVD of her body on the meat hook. That's about it. And then you get the end shot, the needle through the neck. But yeah, when the gore pops up, I love it. A lot of people in the genre love it, but I could see a lot of that being a huge turnoff for some people that are kind of, you know, watching this possibly, you know, underlying message movie. I don't know.
It's funny because as a kid, my first book about horror might have been splatter movies by John McCarthy. And I feel like it opens with talk about the Grand Guignol Theater from France, which is like, you know, where gore really kind of originates. I mean, before any movies to tackle that. So it's funny that the French film would not really be, I mean, other than things like Franju's Eyes Without a Face or whatever, like you don't really associate French film with extremes of like visceral horror until you get to people like Roland. And then it's like, you know, riots in the theater because they're like, what is this? You know, like it's not really, there's extremity, like, you know, in even art films like Godard's Weekend, but it's not really, until you get much later, I think that becomes like kind of hip in some way, but that's a different generation receiving those films too.
Yeah. I think, this is 1980. So this is, you know, I mentioned pre Ogroff, pre Killing Spree, pre Devil Story, tail end of Roland's high point. Like, I don't think even if it had been out there, it would have been well received. They probably would have just been like, you know, qu'est-ce que c'est, you know, and just.
Well, it's only right after Dawn of the Dead. I mean, it's right after, you know, I mean, things that are like, you know, pushing the envelope and elsewhere in the world. It's not like there's a whole lot of gore films in this. I mean, like extreme gore films in the 70s even, really. I mean, we can all name a couple, but it's not really like a prevalent thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Bill,
who sings the song at the end? Is that Betty Becker's doing the vocals?
Oh,
do you have it in your notes?
I don't have it in there. I assumed that it was because she was singing throughout, so I didn't look it up.
But okay, yeah,
that would be interesting.
I can't remember if I'm misremembering it. You can delete this if I'm wrong. But I thought that the film Clash opened with like a dedication to her. Am I getting the name wrong? Did he dedicate it to her? Like, did she die between Night of Death and Clash?
Oh, I don't know. But we can, you know, the magic of recording is we can actually look this up while we're doing this. So.
Okay. Okay, yeah, it is dedicated to my very dear and departed Betty Beckers.
Aww.
Died in 82. So the film afterwards, Raphael Delpar dedicated Clash to Betty Beckers.
That's sweet.
So that's kind of a nice thing. That she seems so tough in the movie, but she's probably very nice in real life.
Yeah. So the song itself, it says, chansons interpretées par Betty Becker's Marta Contreras.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So Betty Becker's was one of the, I was right. I like 5 minutes later, I was right. Okay.
Yay. Well, we'd like to confirm, you know, like, yeah.
Who was the other person?
Marta Contreras.
Anyone from the cast, right?
No, not that I could see, no.
Yeah. Maybe, what's her name? What's her name?
Marta Contreras.
Marta Contreras.
Maybe she's like the moaner, like in Etta Del Orso or something.
Yeah.
Like the shrieker.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that just, you know, to get to the point I was trying to make was just that, you know, Betty Becker's, you know, like clearly had some kind of closeness with the filmmaker. And I mean, she, you know, not only is she, you know, the singer of the theme song at the end, I mean, but she's also, that they dedicate the film Clash to her, the film that the other film in the genre that he made.
Yeah.
That you know, kind of a sweet gesture right at the opening too. It's not like something hidden away at the end. It's like right before we get to the action. It's like,
yeah,
shout out to my friend.
Oh, that's so sweet. I would love to know the story about that, but it's, you know, not out there. So we just have to make assumptions about what's happening there.
Inevitably, like, well, these films will come out in some kind of, you know, Raphael Delpart, like, you know, limited edition, Blu-ray 4K kind of thing with somebody explaining this, you know, these credits. Not me probably, but
no. Oh, yeah, I'm not open to that either, folks. I do like this movie, but no, don't make that person me.
The slipcover edition will have it on the back.
There you go. All right, any other notes you had, Bill, that you wanted to talk about?
Well, yeah, I just thought it was interesting, like, how Flavin always has that kind of, like, riddle, like, would you marry a man like me? Not exactly me. Like, it's always kind of like this weird indirect proposal that he gives, and I was trying to think, like, is this just him trying to make a pass, like, very kind of defeatedly at these people, or is there some kind of Beauty and the Beast kind of like thing, like, if you just kiss me, I'll transform, I won't be this, you know, this figure that I'm trapped in now. Like, I wasn't sure if there was supposed to be, like, some hint of a fantasy to his appearance, that, you know, like, when he talks about, like, why'd you make me this ugly, like if they could just you see his winning personality, like, you know, and go off and marry him, that, like, he would transform. I wasn't sure if that's what they were getting at, because it always seemed like worded in such a way that it seemed like a riddle, which gave it more of a weird, like, slightly heightened fantasy kind of feel than, you know, a straight up cannibal movie.
The underlying sort of fairy tale element. And I think, like, you know, because of his, you know, birth defect and his prickly personality, he's, you know, he's not the ideal mate, but I think it could even be that, and also maybe he sees it as his way to escape, because he asks that question of Nicole, he asks it of Martine, and I think the second time he asks it, and she says, no, you're misunderstanding, I wouldn't, and he says, that's too bad, because maybe he sees it as it's his out as well, because it doesn't seem like he's very happy where he is.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like it is kind of setting him up, like Bill pointed out, to make him a little more, you know, human and humane, like, because he ends up kind of saving Martine at the end with the escape. And I think it's based on how these women, these victims that he knows are victims, how they answer that question. And I feel like, you know, in the back of my mind, I always thought, okay, Flavian's going to save the day. I'm kind of getting that vibe from him. But it is kind of, I like what you hinted on with Beauty and the Beast and, like, the fairy tale element. Because, you know, there's the whole, I got the Hansel and Gretel vibe. They're kind of, you know, giving her this concoction to fatten her up to eat her. Mm-hmm. But also this little, like, Alice in Wonderland. And Flavian's kind of like a character where Martine, and even the way she's dressed a lot of times, she's just out here in this weird fairy tale world with all these strange cast of characters coming at her, and she's kind of handling them all in, like, the best manner possible. And Flavian is almost like, I don't know, not like a Cheshire cat, but he's like, he's really the Mad Hatter. I'm not the Mad Hatter either, but yeah, he's asking these weird, they are kind of riddles. Like, they're proposed as, like, you better answer the question correctly if you want to, you know, go to the next level. He's an interesting character. I think he's just an odd, he's a code you can't crack.
Yeah. I was also wondering if when Mr. Leon stains Nicole's dress with the blue paint gun, like, is blue supposed to represent freedom on the French flag, or is there supposed to be something, like, you know, like, political in that, or is it just like, so we'll remember what this dress is like 90 minutes later when it comes up again. You know, like, I wasn't sure if there was supposed to be something to that beyond, oh, it's a stain that's going to be hard to get out, and, like, a blue stain is especially obnoxious, but yeah. I wasn't sure if it was supposed to be marking, because I think, like, the red, you know, is supposed to be, you know, evoking, I don't know if it's evoking, like, what is it, brotherhood on the French flag? I used to know my Kieslowski three colors so bad, much better, but you know, I think that, you know, I always associated that with the communist thing, with the you know, Mr. Jules, but yeah, was there some kind of thing I'm missing with the blue paint? I don't know. I know it's, like, probably reaching at straws, but it's something I had in my notes. Like, oh, is that something that means more than I think it means? But
We do that a lot, though, because, you know, when you're not given answers for other things that are much much simpler than that. Like, if you're not given answers, then your brain is, you know, trained to seek out answers and have explanations for it. And so, yeah, I mean, I do that all the time too, where I'm like, does this mean that? I don't know, but I'm just going to put it out there that maybe it does.
Yeah. Well, I also thought in a much different way of speaking of like just more like the gothic horror imagery, I thought of Frankenstein a little bit with the whipping when when he rounds up the dueling elderly men with the whip. I thought, you know, of Igor, and it prompts the whole dialogue of like, you know, we are born into violence. I don't like your violence. And I guess it's like just kind of like this pacifist young generation dealing with these, you know, elderly upper class. And I don't know that, like, if they, again, like they touch on these ideas without really following through in a way that's like seems to be making an overt message about them. But yeah, I thought it was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it touches on a lot of those ideas, but never fully develops any of them. And so we are left to interpret them however we see fit. And also pick double features for them.
Yeah. And this is also the only other film besides Argento's Phenomena that mentions the Bee Gees in your cult horror kind of context with the dialogue.
Oh my God. Leave it to Bill to bring up the most obscure connection. Oh my God.
That's amazing.
Fucking Bee Gees.
Oh, you got to close the episode out with the Bee Gees song.
Oh God, yes. No. I got a French cannibal song already picked out.
Oh, okay.
I'll add two songs. Bee Gees, it is. Never putting these episodes on YouTube because never going to get monetized. Oh. All right, so let's do that. Let's move on to double features. And Bill, you're our guest. What were some that you were thinking for a double feature?
Okay, well, let me ask you this: do you want my Euro cult idea or my American horror idea?
I want both.
Yeah.
Okay. So the first thing I thought of was A Virgin Among the Living Dead, the Jess Franco movie shot in 71, released in, I think, 73, has a million versions. Both of the films I thought of were like a young woman traveling to an old mansion with a strange family residing there and problems ensue.
Yeah.
And Virgin Among the Living Dead is Jess Franco. So it's like, it's really pushes the abstract poetry of that kind of premise past the brink, you know, the breaking point for like an average horror person. Like Franco, people are going to be in love with it. They probably already know it. I think that, yeah, as far as like pushing the extreme possibilities of this kind of story in terms of like sex and violence and surrealism, I mean, the Franco film does what this film only kind of daydreams about as far as like all of the adult possibilities with this kind of premise. I think that's probably my favorite Jess Franco movie, maybe. It's hard to really say. He's got a lot of really good ones, but it's definitely up there. But that's the first thing I thought of with this. Nice. If you wanted to pair it with, you know, Night of Death, I mean, Night of Death is the more controlled, tight little movie. And the Franco film is really kind of spacey and probably a little bit hard to follow on first viewing if you're trying to add it up as a story. Mm-hmm. But as a eerie mood piece, I think that's an interesting kind of companion. On the other side of it, for American films, also shot in 71, I thought of the folks at Red Wolf Inn, aka Terror Red Wolf Inn, which came out in 72, the Bud Townsend film, which deals with a woman who wins a contest that she didn't even enter to go on a vacation to like this creepy old house with like this, you know, eccentric family living there. And it even has like a similar kind of, like the young man has a kind of a fondness for this woman, but the matriarch is kind of running the show. And don't want to spoil everything if you haven't seen it, but you know, there's a lot that really kind of connects them narratively, but that's kind of more from a kind of ghoulish black comedy horror. I mean, it actually precedes things like Chainsaw, you know, as far as like films that kind of that new strain of American horror film in the 70s, early 70s. But I don't know. Do you both know that one?
I know it. And I actually had it on my short list to potentially pick for a double feature. And I was going to watch it. And then I creeped on your letterbox, Bill, and I saw you watched it. And I was like, ooh, that might be a Bill pick. So I didn't watch it yet, but it is on my watch list now.
Okay. Yeah. That's I don't think, I know people have looked into trying to bring that back into circulation in the Blu-ray realm. Hopefully somebody will succeed eventually, but you can stream it on one of those Tubi like sites that has a fuck ton of ads.
Oh,
I have
the
bootleg
Flex
of it somewhere,
or,
yeah. but yeah, it's a fun little kind of proto slasherish kind of movie, I guess. That I've always really liked it. That actress is really appealing, the main girl in it. But yeah, those were the two films that I immediately thought of. And I also thought of, I mean, I could think of others, but I don't want to jump off, you know, all of your, you know, potential picks. But those were the first two I thought of. I feel like a lot of people that would know, I mean, you cover plenty of films way more obscure than those, like on the show. So maybe your listeners already know those, but those are the first two that came to mind for me.
Nice. Like them both.
That's good.
Lance, what about you?
So when I first watched this, I started thinking of horror films that have like odd patients in them, mm-hmm. Because of the cast and Night of, you know, Death really stands out. I thought about Hammer's Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell, Terrence Fisher's last film. It has some very weird, you know, mental patients kind of popping up. And then with Cushing on the Mind, I also thought of the Amicus anthology Asylum from 72, which also deals with some interesting patients throughout the wraparound story. But in the end, I focused more on the victims in Night of Death that are lured to this, you know, this single location for the purpose of their blood and guts and bodies to feed these, you know, these immortal beings that you don't know much about. And I landed on a Jean Roland movie, Fascination from 1979. Okay. And for those who haven't seen it, I'm not going to give too much away. I think a lot of people listening have watched it. It's another French horror, obviously. Spending most of the film following these two women, these chambermaids who live in an old chateau, and a group shows up looking for a thief who's been hiding in the castle. And then you kind of watch this ever-growing cast of characters enter the picture. You start realizing that you're watching this planned ritual of sorts involving human blood drinking come together. So, and it off. Obviously, it's Roland, so you have these beautiful, foggy exterior shots, like the ones that really stood out in Night of Death. So I'm going with Fascination.
I'm fascinated by your pick.
Yes. Good. Let's hear yours.
So I went more in the direction of old people villains, either like using, you know, feasting on youth to retain their own, or just them being the villains in general. So I mentioned in our Discord to Adam, because he had already mentioned his double feature pick ahead of this, and he mentioned Homebodies from 1974, and that was top of my list. They're not killing anyone for bloodlust or, you know, cannibalistic rituals or anything. It's more about, you know, landlords being the worst people on the planet. So Homebodies was one thought. I thought of another film that we've covered previously on the podcast, Pura Sangre, or Pure Blood, where you have the old man drinking the blood of young boys. Brotherhood of Satan, I mentioned earlier, although I don't want to get too far into it and spoil the ending, but that could work as, like, you know, old people are being presented as recruiting young children to retain their youth and remain in the Brotherhood. I mentioned, you know, one of Bill's picks, Terror Red Wolf Inn. Cannibal Girls, not an old person one, but kind of in the same, you know, what happens in the film. 1973 horror comedy directed by Ivan Reitman. Because it's a horror comedy, I did not finish it. I did not care for it. So not actually recommending that one. And before I get to mine, John actually suggested Suspiria because of the fairy tale element of it. A young woman new to an establishment, the older people there being sort of mysterious, the given a drink to make her, you know, sleep or whatever purpose they want for that. So I thought his pick was interesting.
Yeah.
Homebodies was on my list also for runners up. So I thought, you know, I would mention that if you hadn't already mentioned it too.
Yeah. It's that movie's fantastic. It got a release, I think, in the last year or two, actually. So
folks, it did. Kino Lorber, I think.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. But getting to my actual pick, I mentioned Alain Delon earlier, and his supporting character, his penis, is my pick for my double feature. This is the Italian-French co-production Shock Treatment from 1973, directed by Alain Jesuit. And yeah, I literally picked this as an excuse to talk about Alain Delon and his penis. But we also have a remote institute where rich people go for rejuvenation, obviously at the expense of others. It's got light gore at the end and a reveal that's very similar to Night of Death.
Is the reveal his penis? No, excuse me.
I've
seen it. Yeah. It was actually on a short list when we first started the podcast. It was under 1,000 views.
Yeah. And when Severin put it out, it jumped over 1,000. Yeah. So now it's off. But, you know, it could still happen for No Rules November someday. I mean, I'll rewatch that scene over and over again. So yeah, Shock Treatment 1973. I ultimately landed on, you know, and these aren't like older people, but it is on, you know, the class conflict that sort of is presented in Night of Death, where the rich people are feasting on the younger, less fortunate people.
Good one.
Bill, thank you so much for joining us for this.
Yes.
Of course. Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. I'm a fan of the show. And so I was excited to be asked to do this. It's funny. I thought of the films that I have in the pipeline for commentaries that I can't say. I did think about the rules of your show, and one has 2 views on Letterboxd, and the other has 1,200 views.
Oh, okay.
So that probably gives them both away. I apologize to the labels if they, you know, people guess them. But
if only we could look up movies on Letterboxd based on how many views. Like,
yes.
So those are, like, you mentioned a bunch of the film commentaries and contributions you have at the beginning of the episode. I know you can't spoil anything that you have upcoming. Yeah. But so that people know when those are coming out, can you tell folks where they can find and follow you online?
Yeah. I'm on Instagram as Supporting Characters Podcast, I think. And then I'm on X, whatever we call it. I don't know anyone calls Twitter X, but yeah, I'm on there. As characters_pod, I think. I never use these things that much. Facebook,
I've
noticed. I'm on. Letterboxd, I'm on. But yeah, you're not going to find it. You barely find it. You can stalk what I watch on Letterboxd is about it. Yeah, no, I guess Instagram would probably be the one. I mean, I share the news on all these things whenever I get announcements to make. But yeah, so those are the places to find me, I guess.
Okay. We'll have links to all that stuff in show notes. Folks, you know, be sure to follow Bill on Instagram and Twitter so you can know about when he's got new stuff coming out. I follow him on Letterboxd, stalk him like I do. maybe then you'll be able to figure out what's coming out soon. I'm just saying.
Oh, I didn't log the. I'm not one of the 2 views.
Smart.
Yeah, very smart. I'm already looking. I'm like, yeah, I'm not seeing anything.
All right. Well, Bill, thank you so much again. This was a fantastic conversation. I thoroughly enjoy all the work that you do. You know, I mentioned on the previous episode that Supporting Characters is one of the most re-listenable, I know, I don't think that's a word, but I'm using it, podcasts.
No, it is.
Oh, okay. Yay. but I really enjoy your work, and I'm so glad we finally got to have you on here.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much. Yeah, no, I appreciate it very much. If you're tuning in because you like my shows, and I don't know if I have fans like that, but if you do, listen to the other episodes of Unsung Horrors.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
All right, appreciate that, Bill. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, thank you.
All right. Bye.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
Okay. Do you want to do your next pick first or Horror Gives Back? What do you want to do?
Let's do the pick.
Okay.
I'll do my pick.
Yes.
We're heading to Japan.
Yay.
I don't think we covered a Japanese horror on the podcast. I did a filter by country on the list and nothing was
really?
Japanese.
Mm.
Well, either way, it's going to be exciting.
Okay.
Also, this is a Toho Pictures. Ooh. So even more exciting, right? The movie is Horror of the Wolf from 1973. It's directed by Masashi Matsumoto. It's an adaptation, the first adaptation of Kusumasa's Horai's Wolf Guy manga series.
Okay.
It's not Wolf Guy. It's Horror of the Wolf.
Oh, I have this on my watch list. And so does John. Thank you.
Oh, here we go. So it's about a young boy named Akira Inugami, who is a new student at school, and he's hiding a secret. Could it be he's a werewolf?
I don't know. That title doesn't sound like...
No. You pretty much know right away. Anyway, one night, Akira saves a teacher at his new school from a gang of punk students who are attacking her. And she realizes that he's different and begins looking into him. And they develop this very strange relationship. And we find out that there's a connection between one of the asshole students and Akira that goes back to when his parents were killed when he was a young kid living in Alaska. That's all I'll say.
Okay. But
believe me when I tell you this, you will not be prepared for the werewolf reveal or the numerous original songs that pop up.
Oh my God. Someone made this movie for Lance.
Yeah. You know why I picked it now.
Yeah.
But it currently has 111 views on Letterboxd. It's streaming on Internet Archive.
That's okay. Cause yeah, even John, like, I remember John mentioning this a while ago, actually, now that I just looked up. I was like, oh, yeah, John's brought this up before. And he is like, I can't find it anywhere.
Yeah, just Google Horror of the Wolf 1973. Click on videos. It's the first one that pops up.
We'll put it in a link in show notes for folks, too. Yeah,
show notes. But yeah, I mean, I picked this episode not only because I think it's going to be badass to talk about, but it's the last episode of September.
Yes.
Which means October's arriving, which means Horror Gives Back.
Hell yes, folks.
Yes. And this movie, Horror of the Wolf, if anybody wanted to like save it for October, it'll fit into multiple categories. Should we talk about the categories?
I think we should tell folks what the categories are. And we'll post the wonderful calendar that Lance has once again put together this year.
Yes.
On our Instagram and Twitter X, whatever the fuck it's being called now, so that you guys can follow along. But in case you need any additional explanation for any of the categories, they're all pretty straightforward, but still.
I made it much more easier to read too. I think I used like some stupid yellow font color last year. Anyway, let us know if you have questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll read the first 15.
Okay.
We're kicking it off Sunday, October 1st, Boris Karloff. Then we have sequels.
Yes.
Day 3's Mexico. Here's a new one. Series episode.
Yeah. So you get a break from watching the film. You can watch like Tales from the Crypt, Hammer House of Horror.
Yeah. Even like the Peanuts.
Yeah. Greg,
that's kind of an episode, right?
Sure. I mean,
It's not a series.
I mean, Charlie Brown is a cartoon series.
Well, that's so what I have on the calendar. So
okay. Yeah, that counts.
And also the good thing about that category is it's like it's under an hour or so.
Exactly.
Okay, day 5 is Castle. So this is William Castle or an actual castle.
Open to interpretation, folks.
Yeah, all these are. Then we have Witches. 1950s is day 7. Germany. October 9th is Unsung Horrors Rule, under 1,000 views. The 10th, we have The Magnificent Carla Mancini.
I joked about this category. I did not think you were going to take me seriously.
Well, we didn't have Italy, and this kind of handles Italy as the country. So, Carla Mancini, you have hundreds of movies to pick from.
Yeah.
11 is Ghosts. On the 12th, we have Japan. The 13th is 1960s. On the 14th, Dive Into Your Physical Media. Or rent something from, you know, your local library or video shop, if you're lucky enough to have one in town. The 15th, In Memoriam, somebody who passed away in 2023.
Yeah, so you've got Giovanni Lombardo Radici, Treat Williams.
I mean, I could just blurt out mine because I already put my list together.
Okay.
Michael Lerner.
Yeah, okay.
Who passed. There's a lot of people to choose from.
Yeah.
Jimmy Buffett just passed away.
I mean, yeah, if you can find a horror movie that has the Margaritaville song in it, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it can be cast, crew, you know, and just somebody involved, writer. I mean, yeah.
However you interpret it. And that's the thing about Horror Gives Back is you can follow our list. You can make your own list, do whatever you want. But if you are following our list, you can loose interpretation. You know, you can... For Mexico, you can do a movie that was produced in Mexico, or you can do an American movie that takes place in quote unquote Mexico. You know, whatever you want to do, however you want to handle it. So continuing on, rest of the calendar, the 16th, we've got The Undead. So that includes pretty much ghouls in general.
Ghouls.
Anybody undead.
Vampires,
zombies, whoever. Yeah. Get them all in there. The 17th, Lance's birthday. Categories, creepy twins.
Yes. Good luck finding. I mean, you could probably find some lists on Letterboxd.
I'm sure there's a Letterboxd list. Yeah. That's actually what I use to find my pick for that. So.
Okay.
18th is Bleeding Skull. The 19th is my man, George Buck Flower.
Mm.
The 20th is 1980s horror. 21st, made for TV movie. 22nd, we've got Goblin. Now, you can, again, interpret this as the band Goblin and mm-hmm. like a pick a film with a score by him or by Goblin, Claudio Simonetti.
Or any of the iterations of Goblin out there. Yeah, all the members. Yeah.
Yeah. Or a movie that just has a goblin in it. However you want, Hobgoblins, if you want to knock yourself out and watch that garbage, whatever. 23rd, Hail Satan. 24th is Tony Todd.
Yes.
Mm. You're forcing me to watch a movie.
That's what this podcast is about. A lot of people turn away, probably have watched all the best Tony Todd movies at this point.
Oh, there's four of them.
Well, there's hundreds of others to choose from, and they're all probably filmed from 2018 to 2023.
All right. 24th, Tony Todd. 25th is Werewolf. So again, Lance's Pit can fit within that category, or the 12th, which is Japan.
Yeah.
26th, we have 1970s. 27th is Folk Horror. 28th is Haunted House. 29th is Slashers. 30th, it's Hammer Time. And 31st, as always, is Viewer's Choice.
Yes.
All right. So looking forward to another great year of Horror Gives Back. We will post this calendar on our Discord, our Instagram, our Twitter, which is at Unsung Horrors. Lance and I will share our watch lists that we put together, always subject to change, though. Mm-hmm. We'll put those in Discord as well. So if you're not there, you should join us there. There's a link in our bio or in show notes to join that. Or you can just follow us on Letterboxd to see our lists. And I'm at Hex Massacre there.
I'm at El Shibe.
Same on Instagram and Twitter at Hex Massacre. Lance is also Instagram at El Shibe. Mm-hmm. So October 1st. Is Horror Gives Back, but before that, we're going to be getting into some Japanese werewolves. I'm excited.
Yes, me too.
All right, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you back next episode. Bye. En la voyant sortir de son camion, chasse les papillons, l'Afrique. Les caribales en le traitant d'espion, arrêtèrent sans façon de suite. Il essayait de leur parler anglais, espagnol, portugais, chinois. Mais en voyant leur mâchoire qui s'ouvrait, il se mit à hurler l'effroi. Monsieur le cannibale, je ne veux pas mourir. Monsieur le cannibale, laissez-moi partir. Et la montra son briquet, son stylo. Ça montrait les photos, sa femme. Et leur chanta un grand air de couteau, les chansons d'Adamo, de dalle. Et leur fit voir des journaux de Paris. Personne ne réagit non plus. Désespéré, il sortit des refus, rempli de filles que tu aies. Monsieur Cannibal, je ne peux pas mourir. Monsieur Cannibal, laissez-moi partir. Quand le grand chef aperçut ses refus, il vit toutes ses filles nues, il rit. Mais dans sa tête une idée saugrenue, une idée farfelue surgit. Dans une case où était son harem, il entraîna lui-même le gars, qui en voyant les femmes se ruer sur lui, avec tant d'appétit, hurla. Oh, monsieur cannibale, je ne veux pas mourir. Monsieur cannibale, laissez-moi partir. Pendant 8 jours il resta enfermé et dut se partager en vain. Et comme déjà il n'était pas bien gros, il perdit 20 kilos au moins. Quand arriva l'instant où le grand chef lui fit comprendre par geste, allez, prends ton camion et retourne chez toi, le pauvre homme s'écria jamais. Monsieur cannibale, je ne veux plus partir. Monsieur cannibale,
aime mieux mourir. Monsieur Cannibal, je ne veux plus m'arrir. Monsieur Cannibal.
Hey, it's Death by Video.
I'm Phil.
I'm Kit.
And I'm Graham, saying welcome to our podcast full of merry movie mayhem.
Ever wonder what an Irish kung fu movie would look like?
It's called Fatal Deviation, and we covered it.
Ever wonder what a movie about a thousand cats would look like?
It's called Night of a Thousand Cats, and we covered it.
And it stars Hugo Stiglitz. Listen to Death by Video to hear us discuss and dissect some of the weirdest, wildest, and wackiest films ever made. All this and more on Death by Video!
Woo!